I hated calculus in high school, and I hated calculus in college. And to this day, I still hate calculus. Now, let me clarify. I was a math minor, so it would be odd for me to truly loathe calculus with my entire being. I hated doing calculus. Calculus to me is like arithmetic made unnecessarily difficult. It's not real math. It's just number crunching stuff. The kind of thing we invented the abacus and calculators and Mathematica to take care of for us, so we don't have to do it ourselves. Having said that, I loved the concepts of calculus. In particular, I was fascinated by two: derivation and integration. Derivation was just amazing to me, especially when I looked at it through a physics lens. That you could take, say, a function that would give the position of a particle at any time, and take the derivative of that and find out its velocity, take the derivative of that, find out its acceleration, and take the derivative of that and even find out the way in which acceleration is changing. It boggled my mind that so much information was hidden in sometimes very apparently simple equations that you would look at, and to the uninformed eye, never know all that data was packed inside if you just knew how to get at it. And then a few weeks later, when we learned the inverse procedure, I was even more amazed. You mean we can back this thing up? We can integrate from acceleration to velocity to position? That's astounding to me. And then I began to study more and more the nature of derivation and the nature of integration. And I was just fascinated by the way that they worked. Derivation is taking a step down, sort of taking a piece out of the whole and holding it up to the light to kind of examine it in detail. And integration is taking a piece and shoving it into the whole, kind of examining the whole thing, inferring from the one component you're looking at what the whole thing is like. And so I think that's going to be a helpful metaphor for us to keep in the back of our minds as we talk about integrity tonight. Because it's no accident that integration and integrity share the same root word. And that root is integritas. It's a Latin word. It means wholeness, structural soundness, completeness, health. Maybe this will illustrate it for you. I don't know if this is a factual story or not, but it illustrates the Latin usage of the word integritas. Back in the days of the 12 Caesars, whenever centurions would do their morning inspections of the soldiers, they'd get out, soldiers would be out there, lined up in ranks, doing their thing, Ave Caesar, all that. As the centurion would go around, as he stopped in front of each soldier to look, make sure their sandals were polished or whatever, and the soldier would have to go, Integritas! And pound on their chest, right over their heart, Integritas! And the commander would listen to hear the sound that their fist made as it struck the breastplate. And they would listen for the resonance to make sure the breastplate was being kept up. It was free of rust, it was tightened, everything was there. Because if the breastplate had integritas, then the soldier was protected. But if the breastplate lacked integritas, if it lacked structural integrity, if it lacked cohesiveness and wholeness and soundness, then the soldier's life would be in peril, for his heart would be exposed. Integritas, integrity, integration. Tonight I want to talk about this concept of integrity in three movements. The first movement, and I don't mean 3 points, it's going to be sort of different from a traditional sort of, step one, step two, step three kind of teaching. Three movements. Movement number one will be the Sunday school movement. Movement number two will be the collegiate movement. And movement number three will be the jazz movement. And I hope that I'll help you understand that as we move along. The Sunday school edition. What do I mean by the Sunday school movement? I'm going to give you sort of the superficial, simplistic, but truthful and core answer here. And then we're going to build on that as we move through the next three movements and get a handle on what this whole subject of integrity is about. So let's get started. God can't stand deceivers, but oh, how he relishes integrity. God can't stand deceivers, but oh, how he relishes integrity. It's a great verse, but it raises an important question, I think, for most of us. God relishes integrity, so great, what's integrity? What is it in its most fundamental essence? I think integrity has got three components: telling the truth, keeping your word, and walking the talk. Telling the truth, keeping your word, walking the talk. They're all aspects of honesty. In some way, they're connected to that. But honesty doesn't quite sum it up. There's a reason there's a word for integrity that's separate from the word for honesty. I would picture a Venn diagram in my mind, and integrity is the overlap of these three components. So when I mean someone, when I say someone has integrity, what I'm implying is that there's someone who is forthright and honest, who does what they promise they'll do, and who's got a congruency between their speech and their behavior. Integrity is considered by many people in business, in other positions of societal leadership, just probably your parents, to be the absolute foundational component of character. Without integrity, it's impossible for you to have sound, mature character, most people would say. I want to make sure you understand, I'm not saying integrity is character. For example, you look at the fruit of the Spirit, the nine that are listed in the book of Galatians. Yes, Galatians. You don't find integrity mentioned at all, and only two of them really are components of integrity, the last two. The other seven have got nothing to do with integrity. What I would say, though, is integrity is the framework in which character can grow. Integrity provides sort of the trellis on which the vine or the fruit can grow. Without integrity, it's simply not going to be possible. For example, one of the fruit of the Spirit is peace, which is a point of character. If you have good character, you will have inner peace most of the time. That will be your state of equilibrium. You'll have joy most of the time. Just because you have integrity does not guarantee that you will be in a state of peace. And it's not synonymous. But if you have no integrity, it will be impossible for you to sustain long-term inner peace and long-term inner joy. It's a precursor to greater character. You can see, I think, the interplay of character and character and integrity in one of my favorite psalms of all, Psalm 15. I love this psalm. It's so short. This is the whole thing right here. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? He whose walk is blameless and who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from his heart and has no slander on his tongue, who does his neighbor no wrong and casts no slur on his fellow man, who despises a vile man but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps his oath even when it hurts, who lends his money without usury and does not accept a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. The word integrity never appears in this psalm, but it's throughout. It's the framework out of which all these things flow. And in fact, I think, incidentally, one of the greatest tests of integrity that you can find is mentioned right here in verse 4. Who keeps his oath, keeps his word, even when it hurts. You know you have integrity when you keep a promise, even when the circumstances under which you made the promise have disappeared, or even changed to be the opposite. Integrity gives rise to a sort of life that allows us to dwell with God, to be with God, to live life God's way, to live in God's presence. Without integrity, it's simply not possible to do. But there's an alternative. We can choose to live dishonest lives, full of broken promises and unfulfilled commitments, hypocrisy, and we might even get away with it for a little while. But the thing about a breach in integrity is it always catches up with people in the long run. It always does. You see, if you have a defect in integrity and you leave it to fester, it's going to evolve. It'll start small. Maybe you're just cheating on tests. Cheating on tests may become cheating on taxes. It may evolve into cheating on your spouse. It's like a snowball. It picks up momentum the longer you let it lie. Not practicing what you preach will eventually become not believing what you preach, and then not even preaching it. Not keeping your promises will become not even meaning what you say. And it doesn't only evolve in a linear direction. It spreads like an infection. We try to compartmentalize our lives. School here, friendships here, church here, sports here, whatever little components, compartments we have set up. And we tell ourselves that what we do in one won't really affect the others. That if we're just the most foul-mouthed, mean-spirited, competitive athlete you've ever met, that won't spill over in other parts of our lives, into our dating relationships, for example, or our hangout time with our friends or our family. It does. It sneaks in. Sin is very, very, very clever, and it works hard to overcome the defenses we erect against it. You guys see this mesh bag right here? This mesh bag has got many, many compartments. Every little hole here is distinct from the other holes, separated by a thing of string. But if I grab right here and lift, what happens? This part over here moves too. Maybe not as much as this part did, but it goes. It moves. We're connected. Our lives are connected just as the mesh weave on this bag is connected. And when we yield our integrity in one area, it's only a matter of time before the rest of it goes. The Titanic was meant to be unsinkable. You guys have probably all heard this before, but it had 15 watertight bulkheads that were supposed to guarantee that a flood in one section would not spread to the rest, and so the ship would not be sunk. Well, we all know how that worked out. Compartmentalization is simply not the answer. The only answer that works over time is to have integrity in all areas of our life, to have structural soundness of our character, to have wholeness to have health, to tell the truth, keep our word, and practice what we preach. Jesus talked about this. What happens when we don't do that, when we choose the other route of compartmentalization? Meanwhile, the crowds grew until thousands were milling about and crushing each other. Jesus turned first to his disciples and warned them, "Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees." That is, beware of their hypocrisy. "The time is coming when everything will be revealed. All that is secret will be made public. Whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you whispered behind closed doors will be shouted from the housetops for all to hear." That verse scares me. It really does. Whenever I read that, I think about all the areas in my life in which I fall short of the perfect standard of integrity. And there are a bunch of them, I assure you. If you don't know me well, hang out with me some more and you'll learn. I try, but like all of us, I fall short. And so I, on the one hand, I really look forward to this day that Jesus was talking about, the day of the Lord. And then I get very nervous too. I get very, very nervous. But then I think about God's grace. And that's sort of where I want to park the Sunday school edition with. If, like me, you're aware that there are serious defects in your integrity, measured against the standard of perfection, or even minor ones that left to fester will begin to grow and ultimately become serious defects, I want to offer you the grace of God and the forgiveness of God. Please remember, He loves you regardless of what you've done, what you're planning to do, or what you maybe don't even realize you've done and should be sorry for. He loves you regardless. And if you will but yield your heart to Him and ask Him for forgiveness, guidance, and direction, He'll give it to you 1,000 times over. And your integrity can be restored. Unlike the Titanic, you can get a big patch on the side and keep floating. That's the first move. That's the Sunday school edition. That's the baseline off of which I'm going to build. Now for the second movement of tonight's talk, the collegiate edition. I suggest that integrity's got these three components: telling the truth, keeping your word, and practicing what you preach. I would like to now talk about some questions that you probably have had in your head, either as I've been talking or at some point in your life, in relation to all three of these. First, so telling the truth. I should never deceive anybody for any reason. Is that what you're saying? Two things. A, is it even possible to live life that way? And then B, is it desirable to live life that way? Is deception always wrong? Well, of course not. Whatever gave you that idea, that deception was always wrong? Maybe some well-meaning but misguided soul, but no, not at all. I'll give you a simple example that I've given before, and that to me is just sort of foundational for my whole system of ethics. It'll sound funny, but it really has sort of become a framework around which I build things. I'm playing basketball with my friends. I fake left and I go right. That was an act of deception. Am I going to hell for that if I don't repent? Of course not! Absolutely not. Why? Here's the thing, and this is the key insight. Because in the context of a game of basketball, people have a reasonable expectation that I will try to deceive them, and no reasonable expectation that I'm going to try to telegraph my movements to them in complete transparency and honesty. The context is one where good-natured deception is assumed. All right, now let's run that through a few different scenarios in life. In each of these things, does the person have a reasonable expectation of me telling them the truth in this situation? By the way, almost every situation of life, 99.9% of the time, the answer is yes. People have a reasonable expectation that you're telling the truth. But let's say that it is a friend's birthday party, a friend's birthday coming up, and you want to throw them a surprise party. Are you allowed to mislead them in order to throw a surprise party? Or are you going to hell for that? Well, of course you can mislead them, because in our society, you have no reasonable expectation that your friends will not try to set you up for a party, and that good-natured deception will be a part of that. If you don't have that assumption, then there's something wrong with you, not with your friend. That's just the way that things work, and everybody understands that. Let's take it up a notch. So you're living at home in Nazi Germany. Gestapo, we're looking for the Jews. Do you have any Jews? Now, there are three hiding upstairs in your attic. What do you say? Why, yes, sir, let me take you to them. Or B, Jews, I ain't seen no Jews. Option B is the moral answer. Why? Okay, the Nazis have put you in an impossible situation. They really have. They've cornered out every really good alternative. They just hewn it away from you. And they come and they put this impossible demand on you. They have no reason. They might have the expectation you'll tell them the truth, but it is not a reasonable expectation. It's an insane expectation. Lie. Lie, 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 lie. Lie your head off. Do what Rahab did, and maybe you'll get into the hall of faith too. Read Hebrews 11. What did she do? She lied. Spies? I ain't seen no spies. And God blessed her for it. The Hebrew midwives in Exodus, I think it's Exodus chapter 2. Pharaoh said, kill those Hebrew babies. And so they started delivering Hebrew babies, and instead of killing them, they'd hide them. And so Pharaoh comes to him, and he's like, I thought I told you to kill the Hebrew babies. And they're like, babies? Man, I ain't seen no babies. They just give birth to them before I even get there, and then they hide them. And God blessed them for it. Specifically, God blessed them for their act of deception in that context. There are times when deception is not only acceptable, it is called for. Now, I want to point out and be very clear about this. Yes, the Bible does say do not lie. Leviticus 19:11 is one clear case. By the way, you have to hunt for it. It's not like in the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments says, do not bear false witness. That's very different from do not lie. Do not bear false witness means, like, you understand what the Ten Commandments are all about, right? They're like the major moral principles. Like, whatever you do, don't violate these. Don't go astray from these principles. And so what the big ten is don't lie when it matters. In other words, don't bear false witness in a court of law, where if you misrepresent what happened, someone innocent could be punished or killed, or someone guilty could not be punished or killed as a result of your fabrication of your lie. Don't lie when it matters. Don't lie 99.9% of the time. I would also go on to point out that I don't think under any sort of ethical construction you come out to simply lying when it's convenient for you, or it makes your life easier, or it makes your friends not be unhappy with you, or something just very selfish like that. There has to be some sort of an extenuating circumstance, and it has to be in a place where there's no reasonable expectation of deceit. Does that make sense? We'll get to the Q&A time at the end, but can I get where I'm going? Okay. So that's question number one about honesty. Is deception ever warranted? I think so. I think, in fact, sometimes it's mandatory. Question number two. So keeping my word. Does that mean I should always keep my word no matter what? If I say I should do something, does that mean I should kill myself to get it done? No matter how radically the context changes from which I made that promise? Again, there's a little bit of fuzziness here. There's some maturity that has to come into it. We have to think clearly about these things. And what if I made a bad commitment? Let's say I promised to supply drugs to my friend, or to sleep with my boyfriend, or to, you know, XYZ. To do something ethical. Okay, what's the worst sin? To break my word? Or do the thing? Well, it depends on what the thing is. No, I would say, of course, don't keep your word if you promise to do something bad. So you've already sinned. You've got a false dichotomy if you think you can put off the sin part. In the act of promising to do something bad, that was bad. You've already sinned. I mean, you're going into this thing with one strike on your record. Bail out while you can before you get two marks. Does that make sense? I mean, no matter how innocuous this thing is, if it is in fact bad, it's better to bail than to do the bad thing. I mean, you've already done the wrong thing by promising to do something bad. And that's just not going to look good on your resume. Number three. So component number three has to do with practicing what I preach. Well, I really can never practice what I preach fully. I'm always, to some extent in my life, going to be somewhat hypocritical because I won't be perfect like Jesus. So does that mean I should just preach less? Lower my expectations? Lower my communication of what I think morality is in order so I can live up to it? I mean, I think college students have that thought a lot. As I walk around campus, I talk to people. I get the impression there are a lot of students who are so afraid of being perceived as hypocrites because they're not perfect that they'd rather not say anything at all that relates to morality or faith. And I think it's a mistake. I think it's a big mistake, and I think it's best rebutted by what Paul says in Philippians chapter 3. See, Paul wrestled with this too. He's just laid out some pretty big talk, and then he says, not that I've already obtained all this, or have already been made perfect, but I press on to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. Brothers, I do not consider myself yet to have taken hold of it, but one thing I do, forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus. All of us who are mature should take such a view of things. And if on some point you think differently, that too God will make clear to you. Only let us live up to what we have already attained. Oh, is Paul predicting this potential criticism of his life? Paul, you talk big, but you don't live big. Or, you know, you live pretty big, but you don't live perfect. How dare you tell us to do something you're not capable of doing yourself? And Paul says, look, I'm not saying I've made it. I'm just saying this is the trajectory that I'm on. And I'm asking you to walk along with me down this road towards integrity, towards this, towards that. If we walk together towards faith, then we're all on the same path. We're all agreeing on what the right value is, and we all have a common agreed upon framework by which to know when we fall short. And we even know what to do when we fall short. We ask God's forgiveness and we keep going. We just need to keep on keeping on. It's not hypocrisy if you're on the right trajectory and you acknowledge that you're not perfect. It's like vectors. I'm using a lot of math stuff tonight. Vectors. Vectors have two components, right? They've got magnitude and they have direction. You're only a hypocrite if your direction is off. If your magnitude is not quite there, if you're a 9 instead of a 10, you're not a hypocrite. You're just trying really hard. And that's great. So don't tone down your rhetoric. Tone up your life. And just deal with the fact that you're not going to be perfect. But that doesn't mean that you should stop espousing the ideals that you espouse. You're not a hypocrite simply because you're not perfect. You're only a hypocrite if you're saying one thing and doing something that's orthogonal to it. Something's completely different. You're way off track. Orthogonal means a 90-degree angle, way off base. And now for the third movement, jazz. This is more improvisational. I just want to hear some questions you guys have, and I'd like to shoot you what sort of answers I have in response. They may be good, they may be bad. Let's find out. What do you guys think? Integrity. Shall we?
You're talking about deception, it's about how, like, if you have Jews up there, just you say, you know, there are no Jews here.
Yeah.
A similar situation would be like a king sends out a command to kill all the Christians, and then someone comes to your face and asks you, are you a Christian? So should you lie to save your life? Or I'm thinking of the story of Daniel and his
friend. That's a great question. Let me rephrase it just because I'm recording this right now. I don't know if you noticed, but I have a little MP3 recorder on, and I want to make sure it's... So basically the question is, you say you should lie to save someone else's life. Should you then lie to save your own life if, say, persecution against Christians break out? The answer is no. And the reason is because the moral issue there is different. The moral issue there is, will you deny Jesus? Which is what you do when you deny being a Christian. Does that make sense? In other words, your life is your own. You have a right to give it away. In fact, you're commanded to do so. Take up your cross daily and follow me. You don't have a right to give other people's lives away. You're called to protect the innocent. That's my answer. Any other questions?